Welcome to Conversations in MedEd, the people behind the research.
Hi, Nabila. Thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Nikki. Thanks for having me.
We have spoken before. I've had you on the podcast where you shared your DPhil research on empathy. So listeners are welcome to refresh their memory by listening to that episode. You have since finished your DPhil. So to get started, maybe you can let us know, how did you survive your DPhil?
Thanks, Nikki. And a joy to be back on the podcast. Thanks for having me again. It really is lovely to be back. Gosh, it was a whirlwind since we last spoke. Lots has happened. And it was an incredible journey. I think for anyone who's completed a PhD or DPhil, it's such a beautiful, challenging, incredible journey. I feel changed at the end of that journey in a really positive way. And, you know, it's just almost hard to put into words that last stretch, because you're so focused and there's almost a myopia, short-sightedness around your project, because you can just see, you know, the next day of what you need to do and completing the next project until the dissertation is written. And it's a huge undertaking. It's a huge undertaking to produce new knowledge, to bring it out into the world, to have it, you know, not only witnessed and seen, but to defend it, to have it peer reviewed, to have it now, you know, published, you know, and to continue to have publications come out of that work is such an incredible thing. And I'm so grateful to each of the people that have supported me, including yourself and my mentors and sponsors along the way. It's a beautiful journey to have, you know, to come to the end of and to see through. So whirlwind. Yeah.
I agree. I'm just thinking back to my own, like you said about being changed, and that's something my supervisor always said to me and that I share with my students. Like, the purpose of any degree or like a doctorate is not necessarily your thesis, but you being the changed person. And so your thesis is just an artifact of your developmental journey. And so I agree wholeheartedly that developing as a researcher, as a person, is the joy and the pain of doing any kind of studies. You mentioned sort of the process and that you're busy writing up your publications now and I can't wait to read them. But maybe you can speak a little bit about sort of project planning and timelines, because I know when you submit, of course, you feel relief, you feel joy, you feel exhausted, but it can be a bit of an anticlimax. Because, you know, you submit, you think you're done, but you might sort of have an exam, a viva, an assessment, then, you know, later graduation, let alone, you know, it took me years to finish publishing for my own doctorate. So do you want to share a little bit sort of on your experience?
Absolutely.
And advice?
Absolutely. Gosh, there's so much that happens within the post-viva period. And for a lot of students, there's the opportunity to like reflect on the journey that has been. And part of that reflection is discovering all of the, you know, various strands of work that you have that still remain to enter the world, right? Outside of a dissertation. So that might be papers, it might be opinion pieces, it might be workshops, it might be presentations, for example. And I think to have that output into the world so that it can have some impact is so important, so powerful. And for a lot of students, planning that timeline can be really tough, because typically funders of PhDs, DPhils, account for the period within the DPhil or the PhD. But that post-PhD period, you know, it can be no man's land, in the sense that you still have some work that you potentially want to get out into the world, and you may or may not have a funding route to do that. For some people, approaching it as entering a postdoctoral research fellowship or postdoc is the way that they can enter a position that is paid, that they are doing work, but alongside it also publish some work that has remained from their PhD journey. For others, it might be that they need to take a break after the PhD of the DPhil and pick it up after that break, and that's equally fine. And for some people, it is a, you know, a shift into a different area of science or whatever the area of their PhD is. And whether that's in industry or in teaching or in, you know, further research or in other areas, picking up the PhD work as a side project potentially is something that happens. And then there are some DPhil or PhD students that, you know, for reasons that relate to funding and timelines, etc., might have to find other ways to prioritize getting that work out. So, you know, it's one of those things that I think can be really helpful to hear about before getting onto the PhD train, to know that you do need to plan not just the pre-PhD period or the PhD period, but the post-PhD period as well.
Brilliant. I can admit when I finished my PhD, I was like, what's next? Like, what do I do? There wasn't sort of a set plan for afterwards. So what has been your plan? I know that you have a blended career where you're doing so many different and exciting things, looking at both academia and outside of academia. Can you share the different roles that you're currently working in and maybe advice about how current or pre-doctoral students can be thinking about planning their post-PhD career in whatever diverse form that looks like?
Yeah, thank you, Nikki. That's a really lovely question. I think in some ways at the end of a big chapter, there's always this like exhilarated, excited feeling, but also that like gulp in your throat, which is, well, now what's next? You know, what's next? Or what's next? You know, and I think for me, what's been so important to me is to bring the different parts of myself along on the journey. And so there's been parts of me that are, you know, as a medical doctor, as a clinician, that I bring along the journey with me. There are parts of me that are, you know, research-based as a researcher, I bring along with me. And then, you know, over the last few months, I have been developing as a consultant and doing quite a bit more work in leadership and inclusion consultancy, and quite a lot of work also in healthcare spaces related to that, which has been really lovely to see, you know, the translation of evidence-based work and research and the interface at the clinical bedside. So that's been really wonderful. And, you know, it's not always possible to, you know, to do everything all the time. And so, you know, with a blended career or blended portfolio, what you really need to do is optimize for the learning that you need at that particular time. And so, you know, for quite a bit of time, I spent focusing on my clinical career. And then I transitioned to focusing on my research career during my PhD and immediately after. I have now transitioned into more consulting-based translational work that blends my expertise from both of those other hats. And I'm hoping that, you know, as I continue building my own leadership capacity, my own capabilities and expertise, that I can continue to carve out a career that allows me to integrate the best that is available for healthcare from an evidence perspective.
And how did you sort of, I guess, enter those roles? Was it through building networks or relationships during your doctorate, pre-doctorate, post-doctorate? Is it? Because I know networking is something we're often encouraged to do, but how do you go about actually doing that to get into these different spaces? Do you have any advice on how we can sort of think broader than academia or sort of maintain the relationships within academia and build new ones outside? And while maintaining, of course, your previous life, not your previous life, but, you know, your first career as a medical doctor.
Yes. Such an important question. And I think, you know, in terms of someone who, you know, has built this portfolio where I bring all my skills forward and continue to use them actively, it's so good to see that others out there also, you know, blending and creating and championing their own careers. I think we don't live in a time anymore necessarily where people stay in one job for the rest of their lives. We're seeing a much more dynamic workforce, and especially in healthcare and in you know, health professions education, we're seeing that different skills are required to answer the problems that we're facing at this time. And so I think being able to innovate requires, you know, quite an open mindset. So the advice that I would give for those who are thinking about developing their careers, taking the next step, because you don't have to take every step at once. It's really only about taking the best next step. And the best next step is sometimes not necessarily your final job. It's just the step that gives you the skills that you need to take you in the direction that you would like to go. And networking, as you say, is vital for developing a complement of organizations, individuals, spaces that you can access for skills development, sponsorship, mentorship, so that you can get onto the road, so that you can access the type of role that you'd like to access, whether that is through a job application, through a conversation that leads to a job. My experience has been that a combination of being prepared, so, you know, knowing what it is that you enjoy, really zoning in, as Viktor Frankl would say, on your why, following that through, not being distracted just by the sparkliest thing or the lowest hanging fruit, but really sticking it out even through the tough things that you enjoy doing, bring you then to the intersection of meeting the networks and the people that can help you to get to that next step, whether the next step is a job, an internship, you know, some form of a role that you'd like to take on. And so I think I would advise young people, especially, or even older people who are thinking of a career transition, a pivot, an addition, to consider the ways in which their preparation can meet the network. Because without preparation, even with a very strong network, there's only so much that you can do. You might have access to talking to some of the best people in the area that you work in, but if you don't have the capabilities, the skill set, the experiences to get you into the room to sit and talk and really have a meaningful conversation, then you'll just end up with a selfie with that person or like a really quick chat over, yeah, you know, a drink. But I think that that intersection of core skills development with network is really powerful.
Very true. That's great advice. So just thinking about your blended portfolio of work, I know you're involved in education, you're involved in sort of workplace consulting and community. Could you maybe share some examples about what each of those sort of roles or aspects of your career look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think let's start with consulting, because that's the thing I'm doing quite a lot of these days. So with consulting, really, your core mission is to take a problem that you are brought and to provide solutions. And so for anyone who enjoys research, that's exactly what the research arc is, the hypothesis question generation to answer. The only thing I would say is that typically the arc for consulting is shorter than the arc for research, in the sense that organizations, especially corporate organizations, but also charities, etc., they have certain timelines in mind that tend to be financial year based, that tend to be quarterly, that tend to be a little bit more pressurized from a time perspective. And so the loop by which projects happen tends to be much more accelerated than typically in the research space. And that in itself is also because consultants use research that has been pre-generated by researchers in academic spaces. So in some ways, it's a shorter loop, because, you know, the R&D or research and development teams that are situated in organizations and in universities, their function, their role is to generate evidence that can be used for public benefit. And so, you know, as a consultant, it's really wonderful to be able to take my clinical skills and my skills as a doctor alongside my skills in research and apply that to problems and see that translation. And so I can look back on the months of working as a consultant and say, well, we've helped to solve this problem. We've helped to address this issue. We've helped to change this policy. We've helped to move the needle on this. And so they're very direct effects that can be seen, studied, monitored, measured. And that's wonderful. I really love that. And then from a research perspective, you know, the work that we are doing and have done, both across the Global North context in the UK and in the Global South context in South Africa, continue to play a very important role in grounding me and keeping me, you know, relevant and accurate in terms of the latest methodologies and approaches and how we can continue to build in a practical sense research. So those collaborations that I've developed remain really profoundly important to me, and I continue to present and publish, attend conferences, because that evidence core is a huge part of who I am and the way that I work. So that's really important. And then the final arc would be, you know, as a clinician, as an educator, as a teacher, that remains so important to me. Unlike many people that pivot or change, I don't see myself as having left behind my clinical work. Even though I'm not currently based in a clinic, I still am very much involved in work that interfaces clinically and enjoy clinical work. And so that comes along with me, depending on where my portfolio is adjusting or increasing or decreasing. So I hope that answers your question, Nikki.
Definitely. I can see your transferable skills, and I can also see how everything is sort of speaking to each other in a harmonious fashion. So like you said, staying in research keeps you grounded. It helps you stay engaged with the latest evidence while producing evidence, and you're directly then using that or those skills in consulting. And I really did appreciate the comment on the sort of the shorter time frame or the loop in a sort of a corporate or an industry environment compared to academia. Academia is generally very slow moving, to be honest.
Yes.
Like, 3 years in one project, yes, as opposed to, you know, 3 to 6 months in solving a problem that needs to be done sort of, you know, yesterday. So I think that's also very valuable, seeing how you're using your skills, how you're adapting your skills, and also I think giving our listeners, just helping them to reimagine what they can do, because often I think in academia we box ourselves. And you're showing how you don't have to be boxed in. You have so many relevant skills that can be applied in different sort of settings, different industries, and it keeps you sort of a sharper researcher and a sharper educator, and it informs your consulting. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you. Thanks, Nikki. That's so helpful. I think also something that I want to say is that for those out there that weren't born just to do one thing, and the listeners who are out there who feel this way will know what I mean when I say this, you know, the jack of all trades at school, the ones that were good at math but also really good at English, you know, and it's like, which one? Or, you know, is that if you have a number of different gifts or skills that you enjoy using but struggle to manifest through one particular avenue, sometimes having more than one outlet for that is really helpful. And that doesn't always have to be a paid outlet. To be clear, some of the work I do is also voluntary. For example, yeah. Some of the teaching that I do or some of the outreach that I do is completely voluntary in my own time. And that sometimes is necessary if you want to have the opportunity to give in different ways. And sometimes it's not always possible to be paid for everything that you do. And maybe you shouldn't be paid for everything that you do, because some of the things that you do from the goodness of your heart because you want to give it to society, not necessarily because there's a remunerative cycle. And so I think a big part of what I do is also seeing my life's work as planting seeds in the type of areas that I think really need those seeds planted. And there are many ways to get there. There are many ways to fulfill that mission. So it's all in the service of that mission of helping to build healthier and happier communities. So that's why I do what I do.
Thank you. Your vision is coming across very clearly, and I agree. I support the idea of some things you just do because you're passionate and you believe in it. And of course, it'd be nice to be paid, but that's not why you're doing it. And I think your message of a diverse career path will really resonate with listeners, especially I feel like, again, not to box ourselves in, but like the younger generation, the traditional pathways are often not working for us, maybe as they did for sort of our parents or those who came before us. And so being creative and innovative in your career planning, like you say, being prepared, not just sort of thinking you're going to maybe fall into an academic job or fall back into clinical work. Think creatively, think broadly, don't limit yourself. I'm finding that a resonant and a challenging message for myself, who I like, being safe in my box at times. So
I
maybe which I would
relate.
also love to be involved in, to maybe have the courage to step outside of the comfort zone and do it if I really care or I'm interested in it.
Yes, and that there's no pressure. I think sometimes at different phases of your life, there are different appetites, needs, wants, abilities, resourcing. All of these things play a role. And at this point in my life, I have the capacity to do that, and I have the capacity to put myself into lots of things. But maybe 10 years or 20 years from now, when I'm in a different phase or in a different space of my life, that may look different. But I think there's that ability to dial up or dial down on how much you are able to give a particular thing and how much you'll be able to develop something. It definitely helps if you enjoy the thing that you're doing. So that's, I think, a really helpful guide is if you're doing something and it's driving you and it's energizing you, that is something that really is something you enjoy. And I get asked that quite a lot of people who are looking to start a PhD, which is, what would be your advice, sort of generally speaking, to people who are looking at starting a PhD or applying for a PhD, looking for funding? I'd say the first thing is just follow your passion. You absolutely cannot be working on something that you don't enjoy for years. Even the most motivated and dedicated of people will eventually run dry on that motivation, dedication, if it's not something that you absolutely love or are passionate about. And to be clear, the question itself does not necessarily need to be the thing that you're most passionate about. But in the area that you're evaluating, you should be working in the area and have questions that are coming from passions. And sometimes the questions will come off of what is most relevant to be studied in that area. And it might deviate from what you've previously thought would be something that you would be particularly interested in following. And that's fine. That's the scientific method, is that we follow the questions that have been provided for in the literature. And there's no way of knowing until you get there exactly the way that those questions will look. But I do think you should be aligned to the area of study that you're in. You should enjoy it. You should be driven by it. You should wake up in the morning wanting to do it, because that is going to be tested within the PhD journey, that staying power. So I'd say the first thing is follow your passion in the PhD. The second thing I'd say is have a very clear idea of how you are going to fund your PhD from beginning to end, including, as we say, that buffer period after you complete your viva. And the third piece of advice I would say is that a PhD is training wheels for an evidence-based career. What do I mean by training wheels? I mean that you don't need to know how to drive. You don't need to know how to do everything yourself. What you should have is a strong grounding in evidence-based methods, how to conduct studies, what is research integrity and ethics, and all of the nitty-gritty skills of, I want to learn how to do machine learning, and I want to know how to do this, and I want to know how to do that, which are skills within your skill set. Those are things that are meant to be learned within the PhD process, developed within the PhD process. You can't learn it all. You can't know it all. So you have to pick a road and say, well, I want to become a better qualitative researcher with these qualitative methods, or I want to become a better quantitative researcher with these methods, or I want to become a better mixed methods researcher with these methods. And you have to pick the road and then find the supervisors that can help you learn the skills that you're trying to learn. So that's really important. It doesn't need to be the most impressive professor out there that's the world leader in a particular area. What you're looking for is somebody who has the capabilities to teach you and the capabilities to guide you to become a fully fledged researcher who has the training wheels off by the end of the PhD. So I think that sometimes people enter PhDs thinking that they need to know everything before they begin. That is not the case. Yeah. And it's also okay to feel afraid of a PhD. It's a huge undertaking. Very few people do PhDs. There's a reason for it. But I would say that the last piece of advice that I would give around thinking about doing a PhD and applying to do a PhD is that it is a huge privilege and an honor to be able to sit with a set of problems for a number of years and really go deep with those questions. You know, to think really critically, to really very intentionally apply yourself almost in a monastic way to a problem and to explore it and to help to understand it, unpack it so that you can provide relevant details to the scientific literature that advance the field. And that honor and that privilege also mean that you have to be ready to take that on in your life. And that is an equation that needs to be squared by you as an individual, which is that, do you have the capacity to dedicate yourself to this thing for X number of years? Now, that may be full-time or part-time, and that's fine, but you really need to know that it is not a small undertaking. That does not mean that it's not worth doing. It's very much worth doing, but you have to be mentally prepared for it to be, it is a long-haul journey, and it will require quite a bit of tenacity and dedication. And what was your experience, Nikki?
I was going to say, everything you said, I wholeheartedly agree with. Yeah. I wish, looking back, I think my one regret is I didn't make the most of the opportunity. I think I took it too sort of lightly. I wish I had read more, read deeply. As you said, you don't often get 3-4 years to dedicate to a single topic doing these deep dives. You know, now I'm skimming abstracts. You know, there's no time to do this like meaningful reflection. It's like rushing from one task to the next. And I wish I'd made use of the time bit, like you say, going to training. I always say to students, it's a balance. You don't want to burn out and sort of do too much, but go to that workshop, to that webinar, to that symposium, because that's often where I had these aha moments where things have clicked. It might not have been directly or immediately obvious sort of the relevance to my work, but just being exposed to, I guess, both the breadth and the depth out there. I was fortunate enough to be a full-time student. I know that I agree that was a privilege to be able to dedicate sort of my life to this one big thing.
Yeah.
But I wish I had, been treated as a privilege as opposed to like kind of wanting to get it done because, you know, I wanted my life to begin and, you know, get to the real part. And I'm like, oh, that was such an opportunity. I wish I just slowed down and engaged more meaningfully. And I do try and emphasize that to my students. Like, enjoy the journey. Yes, I know you want to get to a degree, you want to finish, that's fine. Like, you can have various reasons for why you want to do a doctorate. But try to enjoy the learning. Like, you are meant to develop as opposed to just trying to tick the box.
No, that's a really good piece of advice. I think there is a challenge, a perceptual challenge sometimes in the PhD or in the DPhil journey, which is that there is a very high degree of seriousness that you place upon a degree like a PhD, like none other. And so I also felt this, which is that you feel that every single day needs to be progressive. You know, it needs to, you know, you have your Notion list or your Trello or your like workplace monitoring, and you're the CEO of your PhD, which to be fair, you are the CEO of your PhD. Yeah. A day off, a sick day off is a non-working functional day for the PhD.
Yeah.
So I do think that there is a balance to be had between being a productive PhD student and making headway, and also the other, which is to be introspective and reflective and allow that ruminative process that's so essential to deep and important research. You know, we talk about consulting and how it's a faster arc. That is so important and so true. And it's a different type of work for a different type of implementation for organizations that need a particular type of execution. But in the research space, we also need to be able to have space where really lengthy studies that are deep and are protracted happen, because it allows longitudinal studies that are so important around some of the most important questions that we have to be answered. And so, you know, not to have pilotitis, as they call it, just like lots of short studies, but to have really long, longitudinal work that is able to really meaningfully answer questions, I think is so important too. So, you know, each aspect has its place. And I think there's no reason why researchers can't develop themselves in other ways and with other capabilities. I've met researchers that are also broadcasters. I've met researchers that are popular science writers. I've met researchers that are lecturers and teachers. I've met researchers that are involved in government work and policy. And so the list will continue, because it's just one hat on, you know, the rack of many hats that I think people in positions like research, like clinicians, can develop. And I also think that, as you say so well, the traditional pathways of people just having one role and forever being in that one role has changed. I mean, when I used to have professors when I was in medical school, I'm talking now, you know, over 10 years ago, the professors did their PhDs as the cherry on top of a very excellent career. Right at the end, in their 50s and 60s, they were like, now I have done my PhD, right? Yeah. I'm sitting here in my 30s, and I'm sure you feel the same, with a PhD that has, you know, taken place. And it's a lot earlier than the traditional arc, right? And so we're using these skills earlier. I think that's fantastic. But we also have to move with the times, that the skill set and the role of the researcher is different, in the sense that we have to also do research that is pragmatic.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Sort of the landscape is changing, it's dynamic, it's evolving, we need to evolve with it. And that means, you know, having a diverse skill set and not being afraid to use it. Thank you, Nabila, for your time. If you have any last words of advice, you're welcome to share them, but I definitely have appreciated our conversation, and I'm sure our listeners well, too.
Thanks, Nikki. It's been such a joy to share and to open up the conversation around paving the way for careers. I'm sure that all of your listeners will have their own stories about how they've moved in and out of spaces with regards to health professions education, health professions research, policy, et cetera, consulting. And I think it's so wonderful to be able to create dynamic spaces where we can talk about being able to increase your work and increase your portfolio, also for people to be able to move in and out of different spaces, to have that translational space. And of course, there'll be people that enter roles that are tenure track, and that's the role that they're taking. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. But there'll be plenty of people that want to also develop their careers and be able to enter different leadership spaces. And so I think it's really lovely to be able to sit down and have an open conversation with you.
Thanks for sharing, Nabila. Hopefully we'll chat again in the future.
Thanks, Nikki.
I am Danica Sims, your host and producer. Thank you for joining Conversations in MedEd. Hit subscribe and leave a review. I love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or questions or recommended guests, please get in contact with me. Contact details can be found in the show notes. Are you passionate about education? Are you interested in conducting educational research? Are you considering obtaining a formal qualification in health professions education? The University of Oxford offers a part-time, two-year master's in medical education through the Department of Education in partnership with the medical school. We introduce students to numerous topics, theory, and evidence from the field, and support them in conducting their own educational research project. For more details, visit the Department of Education webpage Links can be found in the show notes.